science and technology education and apply those techniques in their classrooms back home. But is this a problem? ORT, also known as the Organization for Rehabilitation Through Training, says it is a global education network driven by Jewish values. It promotes education and training in communities worldwide. Its activities throughout its history have spanned more than 100 countries and 5 continents. This sounds innocent enough. But in reality, ORT is a linchpin of Zionist state radicalization and propaganda. As early as 2004, ORT launched a scheme to groom and radicalize young people to enable them to lie about the Zionist entity, described as an online Hasbara campaign as a reaction to the growing number of websites that have appeared since September 2000, which voice anti-Israel and anti-Jewish sentiments. It provides a mouthpiece to react to internet hatred. In 2007, ORT, in conjunction with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, created a website to indoctrinate students in Hasbara methods. Even more notable is that ORT is integrated into the Israel occupation forces. They run training at the Air Force Industry School at the IOF airfield in Tel Nof and train students in drone warfare with arms firm Israel Aerospace Industries. As a result, thousands of ORT graduates serve in the IOF Air Force, Navy, and intelligence corps. After military service, many take jobs in Israel defense industries, including Elbit Systems, Rafael, and IAI. One early public example was Karen Tendler, an ORT graduate who was reportedly the first woman to serve in an IDF helicopter squadron. She was eliminated after her helicopter was shot down by the resistance in the Second Lebanon War in 2006. This footage is of her last flight. ORT is one of many Zionist projects below the waterline of the iceberg, aiming to subvert Muslim Azerbaijan in the interest of Zionist regional hegemony.
David, the VT there delved into this obscure Israel-based organisation, the Organisation for Rehabilitation Through Training, otherwise referred to as ORT. I mean, would you say it's just officially another Zionist grouping, or?
So, I mean, it's not formally a Zionist organisation in the sense that it's not a member of the World Zionist Organisation.
No.
But it is a Zionist organisation in the sense that it's part of the wider movement. It's a member of the World Jewish Congress, which is a Zionist organisation. And also it operates all around the world. You said Israel-based. Well, there is an Israel branch of it, but actually the world headquarters of it is in London, in a building in North London, which it shares with the Community Security Trust, which, of course, we've reported on many occasions on this show. So this is an organisation which is which comes from you give the acronym there, and that's an Anglified acronym. Its original acronym is Russian. It's a Russian Ashkenazi Jewish organisation, and it's been historically part of the Zionist movement, and it remains part of it, strongly involved in propaganda, as you've seen, but also, you know, perhaps more strikingly, you know, directly embedded in IDF bases and the Air Force bases, training students to how to do drone warfare. So no wonder they are keen on getting involved with the Azerbaijanis so they can teach them similar sorts of stuff. And of course, that's the main problem here, is that they're teaching the aggressive military imperialist tactics of the Israeli state to other countries.
Well, Kit, I mean, the US State Department cable that WikiLeaks revealed in 2009 is interesting, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of the revelation in the cable that 90% of relations between Azerbaijan and the Zionist entity are actually submerged?
Well, yes. I mean, the cable's rife with absolutely remarkable quotes, I mean, which touches on what we've been discussing. Israel seeks discreet but close relations with Azerbaijan. Israel's attitude towards its customer base for weapons is much more relaxed than that of Britain or the US or the European Union. So, yes, I mean, but one of the most striking portions from my perspective is when it discusses how Azerbaijani authorities, quote unquote, assiduously protect Israeli interests in Baku, which means that when there is a large scale protest against Israeli actions, it must be borne in mind that the Azeri population is overwhelmingly Muslim and by some estimates, 96% Shia. When quite naturally the local population voices its anger at Israeli actions, the Azerbaijani authorities will brutally crack down on those protests, you know, viciously assaulting participants, you know, arresting them. This is not an indulgence which is extended to many other of Azerbaijan's allies, perhaps not even the US or the EU, you know, the latter of which it seeks to join. And so, yes, I mean, we see through how its close relations with Israel, Azerbaijan gets a certain level of access to weapon systems it needs to develop its army that it can't get from other sources. And in turn, this increases the utility and indeed the necessity of the Israeli state's involvement in Azerbaijan. This implants Israeli technology and Israeli personnel on Azerbaijani soil. Now, I mean, you know, as with any occupying colonial power, is the Azerbaijani government really going to do anything to upset its patron or client, depending on how you view things? No, it isn't.
Well, David, I mean, the ORT seems to be, as I think you were alluding to in one of your previous answers, directly involved on the basis of the Israeli occupation forces. And it's closely involved, isn't it, with Israeli arms firms like Elbit and Rafael?
So, yes, I mean, they're embedded in military bases and also embedded within the arms firms. So they train people within the arms firms. Who then, of course, once they've been trained in drone warfare or whatever else, the technical stuff that's supporting Israeli military adventurism, they then go on to work inside the arms firms. Obviously, the Israeli arms industries, including Rafael and Elbit, of course, which both of which have got significant presences in the UK and, of course, have become a flashpoint for the kinds of actions which have been launched by Palestine Action. So we've seen in recent weeks the occupation in Leicester and recently the invasion of a Newcastle factory owned by Rafael, which is a new departure for Palestine Action. So there's, again, another very close connection between what's happening in Britain and what's happening over there.
Mm. I mean, an ORT seems to be involved in Israeli Hasbro has been for a couple of decades or so. I mean, how exactly do you think it sort of fits into that whole sort of strategy?
Well, the Hasbro program of the government, or the Zionist government, is a huge effort, right? They had a ministry back in the 70s, and ORT got involved in at least in 2004, and then more heavily directly with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 2007. Mm. And that, of course, is part of this whole push that they've made through the Global Forum for Countering Anti-Semitism and various other international fora to merge the ideas of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and pretend there's no difference between them, and then that criticism of Israel is itself anti-Semitism. And of course, that's, as you saw with the VT there, the 2004 effort, the first propaganda effort they were involved in, and again in 2007. They're part of the Israeli state's global campaign against criticism of Zionism and against those who stand up for Palestinian rights. So it's not a surprise, really, to find that their core involvement, or indeed to find that they're in the same building as the Community Security Trust indeed. In London. This is all part of the same effort.
Yes, indeed. Kit, I mean, I hope we've still got the link there. I mean, what do you think all this tells us about the Zionist entity's role in the region?
Well, I mean, as I recently reported for Press TV, the Zionists have a wider interest in provoking instability and exacerbating existing tensions between the respective countries. Georgia and Azerbaijan have a very close relationship, to the extent that Mikhail Saakashvili, the Western puppet president of Georgia from 2002 until 2012, said an enemy of one of our countries is an enemy of us both. So by turning Azerbaijan further away from Iran, it turns Georgia in turn farther away from Iran, and it is on hand to provide Georgia with the weapons it needs to defend itself in the event that war between Georgia and Armenia breaks out. The two have, to say the least, complicated historical relations. And yes, Tbilisi's bond with Azerbaijan will always trump its relationship with Armenia. We see the fruits of this in high level military training. There is the dispatch of weapons, but there's also a significant amount of financial aid. And this was most profusely given to Georgia following its disastrous 5-day war in August 2008 with Russia, which began when Saakashvili, with U.S. encouragement, began striking civilian positions in South Ossetia, which is a breakaway region of Georgia. Investors in Tel Aviv reaped a significant proportion of the government contracts for reconstruction. They enriched themselves and they secured a very positive PR for Tel Aviv in the process. And then we fast forward to November 2012, when Israeli occupation forces waged Operation Pillar of Defense. They brutally attacked, without any provocation, the besieged Gaza Strip, and they killed at least 100 people and injured 1,000 more, among them many women and children. This elicited an international outcry the world over, and condemnation. And yet there was a large demonstration in support of Israel in the centre of Tbilisi. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, this all feeds into a wider objective of encircling and trying to isolate Iran and create as many enemies of the Islamic Republic as they can.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm sorry, Kit, but I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, as the clock's beaten us once again. I want to thank our guests, of course, Kit Klarenberg, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing on the first sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about certain important aspects of the duties of messengers. And there he says that amongst the duties of the messengers is that وَيُرُوهُمْ آيَاتِ الْمَقْدِرَةِ, that amongst the duties of the messengers is that they have the duty to show the people, to display to the people the signs of God's power, to show them, to make them realize, to point out to them the signs of God's power. And then he gives examples of those things that we that the prophets point out to us. And that is, for example, he says that min saqfin fawqahum marfu', that amongst the signs is that sky that is above them that has been raised. And we talked about this in the previous session. If a person were to focus and see this way, that look at the sky, especially with now with the technological advancement that we have, and we know that there are nuclear reactions that happen inside the stars and the sun, and the energy is actually the result of some nuclear forces that exist within them. And therefore, one may think that how powerful is God, that these billions and billions of stars that exist in the universe, each of them, all of them depend on God, and all of them manifest the power of God. So you cannot even imagine how powerful God is. And this is, in fact, this is just and just the material creation of God and just one aspect of God's creation. What about the deeper aspects of his creation, the hereafter, the heaven and the hell, and all of these other creations of God that are of the spiritual nature? What about them? If the physical, weaker existence is so much, manifests so much of God's power, then what about the deeper realities of the universe, and what type of power would be there? And therefore, when a person thinks about this, he really understands and has a realization of God's power.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, another thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam says here is that وَمِهَادٍ تَحْتَهُمْ مَوْضُوعٌ, that another thing for them to ponder upon and to make them realize about God's power, and which is a sign of God's power, is the land, the earth that has been spread under their feet, you see. This is such a great sign of God's power also. Because if you are to contemplate on the universe and the earth, how it is formed, the formation of this crust and what exists under the crust and the amount of energy that exists in the earth itself, the very fact that inside the earth there are aspects of how anything can become what it is. Let me give an example. Today, look at all of these planes that are flying, and all of these mobile phones that you're using. All of them are using, for example, lithium batteries, or they're using certain aspects that exist. Or the cars that are moving, they're using, for example, the oil, the crude oil that exists under the earth. So just beneath the earth, there are aspects of God's power. If you just focus on the fact that there are millions of cars right now moving, all of them are moving with energy that is from the earth itself, nowhere else. Energy that existed within the earth. You see? If you just think about this, and then you realize that, man, that is how much you could come closer to God when we just thought about the fact that everything manifests God's power. And everything that is beyond and under the earth, underneath the earth, underneath our feet, is under the power of God and under his authority. What is important, therefore, for human beings is to change their perspective. And this change of perspective comes when the messengers and the prophets make people realize that. The enemies of God, on the other hand, don't want us to think about God's power. They want us to think about their power, that they are the ones who brought about this technology, and therefore we should slave ourselves to these people of knowledge and these people of technology. It is true that, yes, they have done a lot of discovery and they have done a lot of good work in the apparent sense, in the different discoveries that they have made. But all of that, what they have made, is from the power of God in the first place. Like the opportunity that God gave them to be able to understand the universe. And rather, we forget sometimes that many of these discoveries, the sparks of these discoveries, have all been some statements of a prophet of God who made us think further than the apparent level of the universe, and certain inspirations that were given to us to think in a certain way. You see, all of this depends on how we think and how we perceive about the universe. And unfortunately, many people are not thankful and appreciative of God. Anyways, that's another topic. But it's for us as human beings, we need to think further than this apparent realm and think more in a more divine way to understand the hand of God working behind all of these things. And that is when a person will become one who bears divine thought.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, when we think about the universe in this way, and we think about the earth beneath us in this way, that look how much power of God manifests itself in various aspects of the earth, then a person will be careful about how he lives and will be careful about the rights of people, the rights of God, the rights of the universe, because he knows that he is dealing with a God who is very powerful, and he'll be careful about every step that he takes on the earth that God has created for them, for him. And you notice it's only these things that really make good human beings. Good human beings who are responsible, who are thoughtful, who are considerate, are those who have a very true and deep strength within them to make them conform to the values that they are adhering to. And these are those who believe in God, who believe in these signs of God, to think about him all the time in every aspect so that they can always remain firm in the path of truth. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family.
To solve a problem, one has to recognize his share of responsibility. If we only blame others, we'll never be able to solve our problems. And that's one of the things that we have to be teaching to our children, and how they can solve problems is because of learning how to be responsible, actually. And we have been discussing this with Professor Salma Al-Akawi, who is again here to help us with some more stuff in the studio. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
In the previous episode, you told us about being responsible. Some of the tips, like you said, that it's very important to set goals in life and then to be acting on them. Actions speak louder than the words. Our great cards do not speak much about us. Our competence speaks a lot. Our skills speak a lot about us. And we should be planning things. Planning is very, very important. Contemplating over our actions is very important. So what more tips do we have in the store to be responsible, to make our children especially responsible?
Yes, thank you very much. So we were discussing the importance of goal setting and planning, and we said planning is deciding, taking the right decisions, making the right decisions, and we need to help our children to do that. Even as grown-ups, when we want to plan, we need to take advice from others. We need to discuss our thoughts with others. We need to discuss our plans with others and to see what they have to say. So we need to develop this understanding, this inclination and attitude in children,
yeah,
that they learn how to take advice, proper advice, good advice. So if we teach them to make goals, we need also to teach them to be able to take advice from others and those who are more experienced people. Of course, it's difficult for a child, especially an adolescent, who's not ready to listen to many things of others are saying.
Yeah.
But that is, so therefore, the second part comes in where we need to teach him or the child to be able to manage his feelings and emotions.
Yeah. Professor, you said two very important things with us so far. You told us to be setting goals, and then you said planning. A goal without a plan is just a wish. So in order to make that wish, that dream come true, we got to be planning, because an hour of planning can save us hours of doing.
Yes, so we need to do, before we do things, we need to plan them. And in the traditional wayfaring that we had by the sages we had over history, the Gnostic wayfarers, the Arif who used to set out to achieve proximity to God, he would start with musharata, conditioning himself. What is conditioning? It is to plan, is to determine goals and milestones. And we need to plan, make goals, and how to evaluate whether we're reaching them, how to carry out those goals, what are the strategies which have to be employed, what are the tactics, What is the learning required for to achieve that, those goals? So everything has to be planned.
Yeah.
Then we carry out those things with muraqabah, attention, with sincerity.
Yeah.
And then we, every day we need to
analyze
and see whether what we've done, what we've set out to do in our lives. And for every day we have set up a goal, a milestone for every day. Have we achieved that milestone or not? And then we need to rectify the course and adjust if we're making mistakes. That's called mu'ataba.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have, in the traditional sayings of the sages, we have the four stages of musharata, muraqaba, muhasaba, and mu'ataba.
Yeah.
In today's colloquium, you can say planning, doing, checking, adjusting.
Yeah. Professor, we'll discuss more with you on that note. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Naqvi today, and we are discussing about how to make our teenagers responsible. And we have reached one of the tips, which is planning. Well, planning is a skill and an art which takes a lifetime to master. But as we teach this skill to our children at an early stage, things become easier for us and also for them. Yes, Professor, you were helping us.
So we need to, as I said, that's the stage of cognition. That's the stage of understanding. That's the stage of planning, is something which is done at the level of thinking and making the right choices. But then we need to implement what we have decided, what we need to do. For that, managing our emotions is very important. So the second and most important thing is we need
management of emotions?
Yes, management of emotions, especially children, adolescents,
okay,
who are not capable of doing that. It's very difficult for them, especially when they come to the age of adolescence and there are so many things happening in their bodies, changes are coming around, about. Hormones are being secreted and there's so many stresses that they have from within and from without also. So things are getting complicated. So it's very difficult for them to be able to manage their feelings and emotions.
Professor, what about a child whose parents did not have enough exposure in their lives? They were not out much, they were not exposed much, they were not outgoing, and they did not have to face much, and they did not have to manage much. But a child in today's world, where he's exposed to so many things at the same time, like on social media, or like in the old times, you had to go out of your home so that you could be actually exposed to the world. But today, inside a room, inside a corner of a room, you're actually exposed to the entire world or all around. How do this father and mother help this child to manage his emotions?
So they need to become themselves role models for him. In difficult situations, they should be able to have patience and show restraint, and they don't show their anger upon everything which happens, or they don't show their stress, that they're being stressed by something. They need to be able to manage their feelings and become an example for their child. And the most important thing that I think, which emanates and comes out of faith in Allah Almighty, is sabr. Isti'inu bis-sabri was-salah. Seek the help of God, Allah Almighty, and seek His assistance through patience, through sabr.
Yeah.
And that is important, that when we are able to be able to have patience, when we can manage our feelings to a great extent. And one of the tips for being able to do that for ourselves and for our children, that we delay acquiring something which we want.
Yeah.
For example, we want to reach out, we need to do something to eat. We feel we need the desire, we have the desire to eat something, and we can just go and open the fridge and take out something and eat it.
Yeah.
So easily. But if we stop ourselves from doing so.
True.
So that will give us patience. And again, our child, when he, for example, is crying out for us at an early age, at a tender age, children cry out to, they want to cry. They cry and they scream to get things done. You don't need to respond to them, and you don't need to do what they want and what they demand immediately. Give them time. Tell them, oh, okay, let's take a time out, 10 minutes.
Everything has a right time and a right...
You can control his feelings by saying, okay, time out, 10 seconds. Wait 10 seconds, I'll give you something. But stop screaming, stop crying out, stop doing things which are not correct. So here you need to, you know, exercise self-control and also and make your child also control himself.
Yeah. Probably we'll discuss more with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat, ya.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Said Salman Naqvi, and we are discussing the tips to make your child responsible. Yes, Professor, you were helping us with something very important.
Yes, I was saying that we need to develop this feeling of patience, this control of patience in you, in yourself and in your child. We need to develop that patience. We need to delay providing the services he or she wants. If for a child of a smaller age, you start give him, okay, ask for him to be patient for 10 minutes, for 10 seconds. For elderly, older kids, especially the age of adolescence, they want something. They want you to give them their pocket money, or they want you to buy something for them. You give them time out. You say, okay, I can't do it immediately. Give me some time, a week later maybe.
Yeah.
Or if you make a condition with them that if you do this, I'll give you that. So they learn how to be able to be patient in the face of a difficult situation, or even in the face of their desires, because sabr and patience is of different types. One is in dealing with your wrong doings, evil things. You need to be patient in the face of wrongdoings. You go out and you look at the opposite sex. You're attracted by the opposite sex. You need to bring your gaze down. So this is patience in the face of wrong and evil doings.
Yeah.
Patience in the face of disasters. Patience in the face of when you're facing a calamity, a difficult situation. You need to
patience is not just at one place, like where when because what we have a common notion in the society is that patience is to be taught only at the places of trouble, calamities, and whenever you're like facing some dangerous situation or whenever you're sad, basically. You're saying no.
It can be patience can be in different phases, in different ways, in different modes, in different manifestations. Patience in front of your desires, as I said, desires need to have to be controlled. So you need to be able to build in that patience in yourself to be able to control your desires. Or you desire to do something wrong, control that. Desire to do something good, desire to get something which is pleasing, which causes pleasure, you can stop yourself from doing that. That will create patience in you.
Mm-hmm.
And also, for example, you need to be patient in doing, you should be patient in doing good deeds for others.
All right.
I mean, a person requires you to help him, assist him, and it is going to put you to trouble. So you need to be patient in helping him out. So you need to develop that patience also.
True.
And so, and along with patience comes the other thing of thanking, being thankful. Being shukr is also important.
All right. So we will actually expand that tip in another episode. That's all the time we had for today. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Face to Face. Hello, welcome to another Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Very happy to be with you today, bringing you this program, this on the anniversary of the creation of Sepah Pasdaran. And I will be talking to Mr. Mohsen Rafiq Duz, who played an important role in the creation. So we'll be talking about just why was Sepah created and the role that it has played in the past and continues to play today. So stay with us. I think you will enjoy this program. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us here at Face to Face, Mr. Mohsen Rafiq Duz.
Hello, I'm at your service. I hope we will have a good interview.
What was the reason that Sepah Pasdaran was originally created? Was it because the military was from like the previous regime, or was there another reason for that? What role did you play in the creation of Sepah Pasdaran?
The Imam had not yet returned to Iran from Paris when one of the revolutionaries of that time, Mr. Mohammad Montazeri, who was later martyred in the explosion of the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party, IRP, in Tehran, came from Paris to Iran and to Refah School. He first raised the issue with me that the revolution is winning, and this revolution is facing the army of the previous regime. He said it is not a problem for the army to remain, but we need to organize a force that will protect the revolution. He stated that the revolution needs a guard and even talked to many people, and many meetings were held in which I participated until the day of Imam Khomeini's arrival. On February 28, 1979, I was engaged in activities in the axis of the Islamic Revolution when I was informed that the Revolutionary Council wanted to meet with me. I attended the meeting. The late Shahid Beheshti announced in that meeting that just now Imam Khomeini gave Mr. Lahouti the order to form the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or Sepah, under the supervision of the then interim government. They asked me to abandon all my activities and join the Sepah. First, let me tell you how the name of the Revolutionary Guards was created. The interim government asked Imam in a letter to allow the formation of the Revolutionary Guards under the supervision of the interim government. Well, we also went to the Abbasabad barracks, which was near the location of the logistic forces of the army, and during the revolution, it was the governorate and military center of Tehran. We saw a number of gentlemen who were mostly Muslim students from abroad came there, of course. Among them were a few Iranians, like Mr. Danish Monfarid. Since I was Imam's driver and I was in charge of the Alavi school, all those gentlemen knew me. When I entered, I sat down, and on a piece of paper I wrote, "In the name of God, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Sepah, is formed," and then I put number one, Mohsen Rafiq Duz, and then I passed the paper to the next person sitting beside me. Therefore, this was the formation of the IRGC. The reason why we created the IRGC at all was that it's been proven to us the necessity of forming a force separate from the army to preserve the Islamic revolution. Therefore, we thought of forming a force that would protect the revolution from all the surrounding dangers. Later, even in that meeting, we formed General Headquarters while the IRGC itself had not been formed.
but we elected General Headquarters. Mr. Danish Monferrat, who was one of the insider forces and one of the friends of Shahid Rajai and those who worked at Refah School, was supposed to be the commander, and I was in charge of the logistics and the necessary tasks, from operations and logistics to information and public relations, etc. Then my work began. I had to find a place for this force and provide facilities, and we started to enroll. As we were forming the IRGC, we noticed that three other groups under the name of Sepah were being formed here and there. The late Muhammad Montaziri, although the Imam had written the following letter to form the Sepah under the supervision of the interim government, he was against the interim government from the very beginning. Therefore, he went to the university guard, gathered a group of people around him. Among them were some brilliant figures, such as the late Shahid Kolah Duz or Muhammad Montaziri. They formed a group and named it PASA for short. Abbas Amani, known as Abu Sharif, had also formed a group in the Jamshidiye barracks. The late Muhammad Montaziri was in contact with the late Shahid Beheshti there. Abu Sharif was in contact with Mr. Musavi Ardabili and had gone to the Jamshidiye barracks along with people like Javad Mansuri, Mir Salim, and Ibrahim Muhammad Zadeh, who were all prominent revolutionaries. On the one hand, we had seven armed groups before the Islamic Revolution that were in contact with the Imam, groups such as Mansuran, Ummat Vahideh, etc. They were also gathered together in a building on Dr. Shariati Street, which was known as D Building. They had gathered there and were doing something similar to us. They used to call us the Saltanatabad Sepah. They were also active in some areas. For example, they informed us that in a house on Gorgan Street, weapons were collected by the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist group. Well, we issued an order and our troops were dispatched to the location to get the weapons, but suddenly we were informed that Muhammad Montaziri and his team had been there and gathered everything and left. As a person who was older than all of them in terms of age, and I was familiar with all of them, for example, I knew Mr. Aghazamani before the revolution and others. So one day, I invited Muhammad Montaziri, Abu Sharif, and Muhammad Burujerdi to our center, that is the Saltanatabad Sepah. They accepted my invitation. We had a meeting with them for a few hours. First, I stated that our group was legal because we have been formed by a decree, but you have created your own groups all by yourselves. And I said, I also do not accept many of these people who are there. They are good people and they help a lot, but for the Sepah that we are determined to build, these groups and organizations are not useful. You should all get together and make a core. Our negotiations lasted for 4 or 5 hours. I was even carrying a Colt 45. I took it out and put it on the table, and I said that if today's meeting doesn't work out, I'll kill the three of you first, and then I'll kill myself and make everyone happy. Of course, we reached an agreement. From each of these four groups, three people were selected, and the groups were merged into one Sepah force. I informed this matter to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. They were very welcoming. They assigned the late Mr. Hashimi Rafsanjani to communicate with us. Several meetings were held, and the integration was almost complete, and it was decided that all the forces would come to the Saltanatabad Sepah. Among them, in the new round, people like Javad Mansuri became the commander, Abu Sharif became the head of operations, and I remained the head of logistics. I was responsible for the logistics of the revolution since 1963, and I'm still in the same job. Then we prepared this list and took it to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. Let's not forget that the contact person between us and the government was Ibrahim Yazdi, who was the Deputy Prime Minister for the Affairs of the Islamic Revolution.
The problem was that there were many issues that had to be raised with the interim government, but unfortunately, whenever we requested a meeting, he either didn't give time or postponed it until midnight, so he was usually sleepy during the meetings. In short, we in the Sultanate do Abad Sepa decided to take Sepa out of the control of the interim government. Therefore, I went to Qom to visit Imam Khomeini, along with Mohammad Gharazi, who later became the oil minister, and the late Mrs. Dabbagh, who was the commander of Sepa in Hamadan for a while. I was the speaker in that meeting. We told the Imam that we cannot get along with the interim government and have a good cooperation. The Imam asked, "What should we do?" I said that it would be very good if the IRGC went under the supervision of the Council of the Islamic Revolution. The Imam quickly accepted the suggestion and issued an order to put Sepa under the supervision of the Council of the Islamic Revolution. All these events happened in around 50 days. Then we selected some people as the general headquarters and handed them over to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. The Council issued a decree, and on April 22, 1970, the late Shahid Beheshti, who was the head of the Council of the Islamic Revolution, delivered the decree.
I would like to talk about the role that Sepa played in the 8 years in post-war, because it was one that was very active. Can you explain overall the role?
Sepa.
The IRGC, or Sepa, was formed well. That is, all its members were so devoted that they were ready to die for the revolution. Therefore, the works done by the IRGC was great and valuable. I mean, for example, first it put an end to the Two-Day Party, and then when it found out that the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist group was gathering weapons, it did intelligence work on this terrorist group, and then slowly those concepts settled among the people that the IRGC was to defend the Islamic Revolution and stands against any danger. Because, you know, the history of the Islamic Revolution, at least between 63 and 100 anti-revolutionary groups have been formed, such as the Forghan group, the Iranian People's Fedayi guerrillas, and others. This continued until the Iraqi attack on Iran. Iraq had waged war against Iran based on a precise military calculation. And if it was not for the role of the IRGC and the people did not defend, Saddam would have taken over Tehran after 6 days. Why? Because people have been grappling with the army for nearly 2 years after the Islamic Revolution. Of course, the army leaders were present at the war, and the army's military equipment helped a lot. When the revolution triumphed, the military equipment, the army were almost out of order. I mean, Iraq, Saddam attacked Khuzestan, where the 92nd Armored Division of Ahvaz, which was expected to have cannons, tanks, and armored personnel carriers, had only two healthy tanks. It merits a mention that at the beginning, even the Sepa did not enter the war in an organized manner and under the supervision of irregular headquarters. That is, when the nation felt that an army had entered the country, first of all, the Sepa of Mashhad went in, then the Sepa of Isfahan dispatched forces to the region, and then the Sepa of Tehran. One of the things I did myself was to go to Ahvaz to establish a connection and coordination between these different groups of the IRGC. May God have mercy on martyr Zahir Nejad, who was graduated from a military university. He used to say, if Iraq has 500 tanks, we should have 1,000. We must always have more. As a result, we defended against the enemy's invasion, and we proved that we can drive the enemy out of the country. But when Imam Khomeini ordered that the siege of Abadan should be broken, the army forces that were trained went into action. The IRGC also trained the same popular forces and entered the Holy Defense, and the joint interaction of the IRGC and the army succeeded in breaking the siege of Abadan. This was the first successful experience of defeating the enemy with people's forces that lacked cannons and tanks, while the enemy had everything on the other side. A change was made in the war. Bani Saad was in power, but he had a wrong logic. He was against the existence of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, and its formation and its involvement in the war. And he believed that the war should be managed by the army. And he also believed that we should give land and buy time. In my opinion, he was a spy and a traitor. Mohsen Rezaei, who became the commander of the IRGC, brought good changes to its force. That is, before him, there were just waves of people. But within a short period of time, we had battalion at first, then brigades were created, and then divisions and then corps. If we look back at the Sepah of 1983, we see 20 divisions and 20 commanders in the IRGC, the eldest of which is 23 years old. And one of them is the great martyr, General Qasem Soleimani, and other personalities such as Hossein Kharrazi, Ahmad Kazemi, Hemat, and Motevasilian. All of these are young commanders against whom Iraq was powerless. A powerful Sepah was created that shone brightly in the war. Of course, we never deny the presence of the army in the war and its effective and influential presence. Many of the army forces were martyred during the war. When the constitution was being written, many institutions were formed, such as the Martyr Foundation, the Relief Foundation, the Literacy Movement, and the Jihad of Construction. And of course, one of them was the IRGC. The only institution that was included in the constitution was the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which, in fact, the Islamic Revolution Corps was in Article 150 of the first constitution, which states that the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps will continue its role as a guardian of the revolution and its successors. Its limits and duties are defined by law. And that's how the Sepah continued to exist. Well, in the war, as it was known, both the army and the Sepah, or IRGC, carried out operations, both separately and jointly. That is, whenever it was decided that one of those two military branches should carry out a military operation, the Supreme Defense Council would take the plan, and if it was approved, the operation would be carried out. And sometimes we merged. For example, in the FAV operation, since the army commander of the time did not believe in that operation and the Sepah was assigned to perform its duty, all the army's artillery was assigned to serve the Sepah or IRGC. Well, the Sepah had become a powerful force that has a large number of divisions, brigades, and battalions. It has captured military equipment from the enemy. I also provided facilities for the Sepah as a logistics officer, and a ground force was formed. We had also created a naval unit. I had brought a number of boats and light vessels for the Sepah, but overall it was nothing remarkable. Until 1986, when I was in North Korea, I received a call and I was ordered to return to Tehran as soon as possible because Imam Khomeini had ordered the formation of the three IRGC forces, land, sea, and air forces. Of course, the order to form the Quds force came later. Then there was a division of labor between the army and the IRGC. That is, for example, the forces operate regionally in such a way that the IRGC's navy is based in this port, the army's navy in another area. They should help each other whenever necessary. The ground forces of the IRGC could also be divided regionally, but in the Air Force, it was divided in such a way that the Air Force was given to the IRGC, but the Air Force of the Army remained the same.
Sepah has entered different fields. One of the fields that it entered was producing military equipment. I'd like you to talk about that and why that started and how effective it has been.
When we recaptured Khorramshahr, there were two ideas in the country. One idea was to accept the truce. Another idea was that, no, we should continue the war. I agreed with the second point of view. Our reason was that why should we end the war except that we recognized Iraq and Iraq also recognized us? Iraq, from a military point of view, the strategic points of our borders are in the hands of the enemy, and we had only liberated Khorramshahr. Therefore, we had to proceed until the complete elimination of the army and the fall of Saddam. In the end, Imam Khomeini allowed the war inside Iraq after setting very strict conditions. For example, one of the conditions was not to fight inside the cities. where the ordinary people are, and we should fight on the borders. 6 years after the liberation of Khorramshahr, the war continued, until the world was forced to propose the resolution 598, which was relatively in our favor. The Imam also accepted the resolution under some conditions, but it was actually the best time to accept. This is where the issue of the IRGC's measures to produce military equipment is raised. Why? Well, we were in desperate need of military equipment, so we went to the Western countries. They said they wouldn't sell us weapons. We went to the Eastern countries. They said they wouldn't sell weapons for two reasons. One, the Soviet Union doesn't allow it. And the second, they had already sold everything they had to Iraq. Two countries only, that's Syria and Libya, helped us. Syria itself had nothing to give us, but I went to Syria with some Syrian officers. We went to Bulgaria, for example. They bought weapons from Bulgaria, but in reality, the purchase was for Iran. We would send a ship, and it would change its route, and eventually the weapons would enter the country. It was very hard. Therefore, on the same date, I thought that we should produce our own military equipment inside the country. Therefore, anyone who claims can help, we would welcome it. Regarding our first